It's one of the thoughts in one of the verses of that song that we just sang that very pertinent to one of the points we're going to try to make tonight. So I want to turn that so I can look at that again when we get to that point in the lesson. All right. Well, that won't work. As I open my papers, the first sheet says Carolyn Legg's famous tomato basil pie. That's good, but it won't preach. So some challenges a congregation must meet is what we need to talk about tonight. The devil certainly wants to obstruct us both individually and congregationally with every kind of problem that he can devise to throw in our path. And we can expect that to be the case as long as this world lasts. He intends, if he can't keep us from obeying the gospel, he wants, after that point, to try to discourage us and hope that he can thwart us in every possible way to not do any more than just a bare minimum of the Lord's work. And we want to talk tonight about having an attitude in which we determine that we're just not going to let the devil hinder us, as he certainly desires to do. And when the Lord sent the seven letters to the churches that we have recorded in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, it's interesting to look at those seven very different letters written to congregations that were in seven very different situations. It would be interesting today, wouldn't it, if the Lord picked seven congregations and sent a personal letter to each of those churches and gave his analysis of what was going on there, the good and the bad. And that's what you have in these letters. And it's interesting for us 2,000 years later to look back and see the kinds of things that they struggled with, the kinds of problems that they had to face as congregations. Many of them sound very similar to the kinds of difficulties that we continue to have to deal with. But to the church in Philadelphia in chapter 3 of Revelation, Revelation chapter 3, I want you to look at a statement that he makes in verse 11 when he says to these brethren, "Hold fast what you have so that no one may seize your crown." They had a crown waiting for them. It's that crown of righteousness that Paul talked about being so eager to receive when the race had been run. The Lord says to these people, "You have a crown waiting for you. Make up your minds that you're not going to let the devil take that crown away from you. Have enough determination to hold on to your salvation that you refuse to let the devil or anyone doing the devil's service to seize what belongs to you, to take away your inheritance." In every possible way, the devil would like to hinder us. Paul speaks on more than one occasion of having had to deal with hindrances of the devil in his work. You know, he said to the Thessalonians that more than one time he had wanted to come back and revisit them, but the devil had hindered that, at least to that point. Well, the devil can hinder us in a lot of different ways, both individually and congregationally. I think our challenge sometime is to see where we're being hit the hardest. Sometimes the devil changes where he's attacking us, and he would be delighted if we misunderstood where he's doing the greatest damage, so that we think we're fighting him over here, but over here is where he's really doing the greater damage. The kinds of things that I want to talk about tonight are some just very practical kinds of problems that I think are those that we don't normally think very much about when we're thinking about church problems, but I believe these are challenges that we need to determine that we're going to meet. And one of them, and I deliberately put this one first because I think it's very important, we have the challenge of trying to remember what our work is. The devil would like us to forget what our work is and be busy about all manner of other things while not focusing on that which the Lord wants us to be busy about right now. And obviously, we can't do our work if we don't understand what that is. But even when we do understand what our work in the Lord is, it's easy for us to become distracted or become tired or lose our focus. And the result of that, I'm afraid, often is discouragement. When we lose our focus on what it is the Lord has assigned us to do, we become unnecessarily discouraged, I think. You remember back in the Old Testament, in Jeremiah, you see this both in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. In Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 27, when the Lord was commissioning Jeremiah to go and preach to the people, to come back to the Lord, you know, the Lord said to Jeremiah in chapter 7 and verse 27, "You shall speak all these words to them, but they will not listen to you. You shall call to them, but they will not answer you." What was Jeremiah's job? What was his mission? To bring the people of Israel back to the Lord? No, his mission was to deliver the message the Lord wanted to these people. And he was told up front that they weren't going to listen. A lot of people who would say, well, if we know they're not going to listen, why waste the time that it takes to deliver the message? Well, the Lord has his own reasons for wanting certain things placed on record. He wants people confronted with certain information, certain truth. What they do about that is between them and the Lord, but our job is much like the job of Jeremiah in that our job is to take the message from the Lord to those who need to hear it. We are messengers. We are couriers in a certain sense, and we need to stay focused on the fact that that's our part of the work, relaying the message, regardless of response. Now, we are obviously delighted when there is some kind of positive response, and we should rejoice about that. But we need to keep clear in our mind what our part of that work is, and it is simply disseminating as much information as we can to those who need to hear the word of the Lord. As I said, you know, the Lord said essentially the same thing to Ezekiel over in Ezekiel chapter 2 and verse 7. He said, "You shall speak my words to them, whether they hear or refuse to hear, for they are a rebellious house." The New Testament, of course, Paul in 1 Corinthians puts it in terms of planting and watering and harvesting, doesn't it? The harvesting part is the Lord's work, but Paul's speaking of himself and Apollos, that I planted and Apollos watered, but it is the Lord who gives the increase. Well, the planting and the watering part, that's the part that human beings are able to engage in. The harvest involves a lot of circumstances that are totally out of our control. But that's not the work that the Lord has assigned us. Ultimately, what is the Lord going to expect us to have done? If we were to have a job appraisal every so often, like we sometimes have, you know, in the business world, how would we be evaluated as to whether we're doing our work or not? How would you measure that? How many people are baptized? No. But I believe you could measure whether we are doing our work in most communities in terms of how much information about the Lord we're putting out into the community. How many people are being confronted with the chance to say yes or no to the Lord? And the fact of the matter is, in this day and time, we have many, many tools for disseminating information that people didn't have in ancient times. There are a lot of ways for us to get the information about the Lord out of this building, out into the community around us. And we need to use every one of those tools. We don't just pick one and say, this is the only tool. We use every one that has any chance of any effectiveness. I believe ultimately the Lord want to know from us how many people were left unbaptized in our communities, but how many people were left in our community that we never confronted with the gospel in any kind of way. We can do that. We can sow the seed and leave it in the Lord's hands. Many years ago, a very well-known older gospel preacher came to hold a meeting where my parents were living. And I happened to be home that summer from college. And this preacher arrived on Sunday morning, just in time for services, on Sunday morning for the meeting to start, and he was driving, and back in those days, before GPS and all of that, he had neglected to get directions to our church building, and so as he came into town, he stopped at a service station, if you remember what those were, to ask if anybody knew where the Church of Christ was. Well, where he stopped happened to only be a couple of blocks from our meeting place, but the person that he asked said, "No, I've never heard of them." Well, this brother finally found where we were, and in his sermon that Sunday morning, he just blistered us good. He said, "Folks, you may not baptize as many people as you'd like, but you can make enough noise that the people in your neighborhood know you're here." And he's exactly right. And that's our job, sowing seed, disseminating information about the Lord in every possible way. We can have a make enough noise, if you want to put it that way, so that at least people know we're here and know at least a little bit about what we stand for. That's doable. You know, the Lord has never assigned anybody an impossible task. Whatever it is he expects us to do, it's always going to be doable. And we can publish information about people. We can ask people for studies. We can give them a chance either to say yes or no to that. And we can do that. We of course, are constantly tempted to bypass that work and be busy about all manner of other things that might be related indirectly to the work of seed sowing, but we forget, and the devil would like for us to forget, that our work is sowing the seed. And I'm suggesting to you tonight that we need to be congregations in all the various places where we live who keep focused on what our work is, sowing the seed of the kingdom. We need all of us to be worshiping with groups that are like the Lord said that Paul said the Thessalonians were like when he said, "From you has sounded forth the word." They had sounded forth the word far beyond their immediate neighborhood. People far and wide had heard the gospel as a result of what the Thessalonians were doing, and we need to be that way. I believe there's an energy that comes from staying focused on our work that we don't have when we forget what the Lord has assigned us to do and we start tending to all manner of other things and we become discouraged because it seems like we're not accomplishing anything. Well, we can always accomplish that which the Lord has given us to do, and we need to stick to that and stay focused on it and be doing more and more and more of that every day. And so it's a challenge to keep that in mind. It is a matter of fact that we are living in a time when you will hear more and more people question whether evangelism is our work or not. I talk to more and more people all the time, some of whom are otherwise very conservative brethren, who would say we've been placing too much emphasis on evangelism and not enough emphasis on ameliorating the evils that are in this world, feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and so forth. In fact, one of the members of the congregation where I worship back in Nashville just a few Wednesday nights ago in Bible class, our elders throughout this year have been trying to emphasize evangelism. And this member raised his hand in Wednesday night Bible class in the auditorium adult class and said, "I wish we'd quit emphasizing evangelism so much and start emphasizing benevolence." Well, we need not neglect benevolence as the Lord defines it. I don't find much, if any, record in the book of Acts after the establishment of the church, of brethren being too much concerned to show benevolence to anybody but fellow brethren, as a matter of fact. But we certainly need to be compassionate. We need to have a social consciousness. We need to have broken hearts for the people that are hurting in all kinds of physical ways and give the cup of cold water in the Lord's name every time we get a chance to do that. But that's not the primary focus of our work. The Lord commissioned his disciples to go make disciples. That's our marching orders. And we need to not ever let anyone, internally or externally, cause us to forget that our primary work is sowing the seed of the kingdom. And then other things will be taken care of as we have opportunity. But it's a challenge to keep in mind that our primary work is that of sowing the seed of the kingdom. And there's not a one of us who can't do something that's related to that work. We'll each have different roles as we try to together sow the seed of the kingdom. You might not be able to do anything but, you know, lick envelopes that we're stuffing to mail out into the community. But there's something every one of us can do that will help the work of seed sowing, and we need to stay focused on that. One thing that keeps us from staying focused on the sowing of the seed of the kingdom is that we get bogged down in petty, selfish little concerns. And I suggest that one of the challenges that we need to meet is the challenge of living above what I'm calling pettiness. And by that I mean just small self-centered thinking about whether people are treating me as they ought to, and whether somebody's said something to me they ought not to have said, and all those kinds of personal things. You know, selfishness and gossip and factionalism and all of those petty things have always been the bane of the Lord's work. I think we see that even in the New Testament, don't we? Even in a letter like Philippians, where almost everything Paul said to his beloved brethren in Philippi was very positive. If there was a problem at Philippi, it seems that they weren't working together quite as they should, that there was a little bit of internal friction there. And so Philippians 2 and verse 3, for example, Paul could say, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others." And over in chapter 4, he even mentions two of the sisters in the congregation by name and says, "I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord." Work together. Don't get distracted by small, selfish, petty concerns. One of the things that can really help us in life and in general, but especially in the Lord's work, is to try to maintain a sense of proportion and priorities. You know, not all problems are equal. Some problems are bigger problems than others. Some issues need to be tended to more than other issues do. And in the greater scheme of things, little personal issues don't matter as much as bigger issues that have to do with the Lord's work. Even if there is a valid, maybe a wrong has been committed, there is some issue that needs to be worked out, the most you can make of that is that doesn't matter as much as the greater concern of the Lord's work. And the Lord calls us to higher ground with regard to these little personal frictions that can come up from time to time. But it's disastrous when we start majoring in minors, pursuing concerns that even at their greatest don't matter all that much. We get bogged down in all of that. We're not going to be doing job number one, and that is sowing the seed of the kingdom. But it is a challenge, isn't it, to put little selfish things in their proper perspective, deal with them if need be, spend, you know, a minimum amount of time working on those things, but if that doesn't work, then just move past it. Don't let that distract from the greater focus that we ought to have on the Lord's work and whether His honor and His glory are being preserved. I'm amazed, if you're still in Philippians, you know the statement Paul makes in chapter 1 and verse 15 about some of his enemies. I just so admire Paul for having this kind of perspective. He's talking about those who are preaching the gospel, and he says in verse 15, "Some preach Christ from envy and rivalry, impure, selfish motives for preaching the gospel." Is that good? Is that right? No. He says, "Others preach from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former," here are his enemies, "proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment." Well, if you're Paul, what's going to be your attitude about that? Men unfairly criticizing you and even glad that you're in prison because now you can't be holding gospel meetings and they can be holding all of them. What's going to be your attitude? What was Paul's in verse 18? What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. In that I rejoice. That's a big attitude. Now, Paul is not condoning their ungodly attitudes for preaching the gospel. If they continue to do that and fail to repent of it, you know, it would cost them their souls. But Paul is able to put that in perspective and say, however heartbreaking that might be, that these fellows end up being lost, if they have truly preached the gospel of Christ and somebody has obeyed it, then in the bigger perspective, wouldn't we focus on rejoicing about that and not pay quite so much attention to the fact that they don't like me and are making unfair criticisms against me? Many years ago, I had somebody in the congregation where I was preaching at that time decided that they did not like me in a deeper sense than I've ever been disliked in my life. I've had a lot of people that just didn't care for me, but these people just despised me. They would not shake hands with me in the church building. They made some very false accusations against me and just could have made life very miserable for me in many ways if I'd let them get to me. But I determined that I was simply going to move past it. I was not going to allow their negative energy to distract me from the work that I needed to be doing. For my part, I would continue to be as polite to them as I could, talked with them about the issues involved, had made an honorable effort to try to resolve the issues, but it was obvious that they were not going to let that be resolved. They derived some kind of perverse pleasure from despising me. And so after a while, I determined just to move past it, just to ignore it. And there was a member of that congregation that said, "Gary, you're going to take that kind of treatment?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You can't do that. You've got to deal, with these things." And I said, "Well, I have tried to deal with it as honorably as I know how, but it hasn't been able to be resolved. And so for my part, I'm simply going to get back to the Lord's work." He said, "You can't do that." He said, "You've got to resolve every issue. You can't sweep anything under the carpet," as he said. Well, I said, "Do you do that?" He said, "Every time anybody does anything against you, do you pursue that until the person apologizes to your satisfaction? When somebody cuts you off in traffic, do you follow them home and not do anything until that person has made that right?" He said, "Well, no, some things you have to let go." I said, "Amen." And there's not anything anybody could do against me personally that ranks anywhere near high enough that it should so distract me that I quit doing the Lord's work, or that I forget that I dare not pursue the satisfaction of that personal issue in any kind of way that hinders the Lord's work in this community or distracts from His glory and His honor, especially in the eyes of the community. That's exactly why in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul says that we're not to take one another to court. Here's a brother who has defrauded you. A real wrong has been done that has cost you significant financial loss. What do you do about that? You go to him brother to brother, seek to straighten that out. Let's suppose he doesn't want to straighten that out. Maybe he denies that any wrong has been done. You've got a significant difference here over even what the facts of the case are. Well, you would involve other brethren. Paul's point here is, if you can't resolve that brother to brother, and there's not even somebody in the congregation wise enough to mediate that dispute to everybody's satisfaction, then you take the wrong. You let yourself be defrauded rather than say, this has got to be set right. If I have to take this person to public court, I'm going to do it. And what's the result of that? Paul says it's an admission of defeat for you in the eyes of the community when you make it publicly obvious that you don't even have anybody in your own number who can help you work out your own differences. You've got to have an unbeliever settle your differences. And look at what that does to the cause of the Lord in the community. Paul's point is, that you don't pursue any personal grievance in any kind of way that detracts from the Lord's honor or his work or his cause in the community. If it takes turning the other cheek to a serious financial defrauding, you would rather take that than obstruct the Lord's work. No matter what has been done to you, that's a trivial concern in comparison to whether the Lord's work is going forward or not. And I'll tell you, it's a challenge to all of us, isn't it? To keep personal, petty concerns in the realm of the trivial, which is where they all really ought to belong. If somebody's done something to me, certainly that becomes a major issue that's even more important than evangelism right now until we get this straightened out. And it's just not. We ought to all have enough passion for the work of evangelism and the Lord's glory in our community that there's nothing of a selfish concern, even if you're Paul and people are hate you so bad they're glad you're in prison right now. Paul's attitude was, well, they're preaching the gospel, other people are hearing that, and let's be glad for that. That's a big attitude, but we need to strive to have that. You know, many of us can operate, but we don't seem to be able to cooperate very well. The Lord's work is a cooperative endeavor. It's a collaboration. And we need to be able not just to sound forth the word, but as Paul says to the Philippians in chapter 1 and verse 27, let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. I believe that's putting the priority in the right place. Standing shoulder to shoulder, committed to the cause of the gospel in our community. And whatever differences exist between us personally don't matter in the large scheme in terms of the Lord's battle between his adversary. And we've taken the Lord's side and we're going to try to do his work regardless of personal issues. The Lord's glory ought to be more important. It ought to make a huge difference in the way we even approach settling personal differences. So that's a challenge. Don't you think the devil is smart enough to know that one of the best ways he could keep you from sowing the seed of the kingdom here in Gettysburg is to get you preoccupied with petty differences? That would do it, wouldn't it? So we need to make up our mind we're not going to let that happen. We'll get out of our little itsy-bitsy thinking and get back to the big thinking about the work of evangelism. In regard to that, I suggest that it's a challenge for us to continue to believe that we can make a difference in the communities where we live. Sometimes it can seem like we're outnumbered and that the magnitude of the work is beyond what we can do with our little number and our little resources. It takes discipline to believe that with the Lord's help, significant change for good is possible, yes, even where we live, no matter where that might be. You know, we used to hear hope defined as what? Desire plus expectation. It's a pretty good way of describing hope. You know, if all you have is expectation, maybe it's something that you expect is going to happen, but you dread it happening. That's not hope. And if there's just something that you hope for, but you don't have any realistic expectation that it's going to come to pass, that's not hope. But if you expect that it's going to come to pass and you greatly desire that it does come to pass, that's hope. And without a certain amount of hope, our work in the Lord just ceases, doesn't it? You'll quit after a while if you don't have any hope. We need to maintain hope in the strength of the Lord. If we do his work in his way, that good will be accomplished. Whether we can see it or not, whether we live long enough for the harvest to come in or not, that it does good to do good. And we work in that confidence. We work in that hope. Back in Revelation chapter 3, remember, just a few verses above where we were a little while ago in the letter to Philadelphia, he said, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I'm impressed with that. We pray for opportunity And that's a prayer the Lord would certainly want us to pray. And when he answers that prayer, when he opens doors, not even the devil has the ability to shut those doors. The devil has a certain amount of limited power to try to thwart the Lord's work for in the here and now. But his power is limited. And we need to work in the confidence that the one whom we serve is the Lord. And when he opens doors of opportunity before us, not even the devil can shut those doors. Yes, our little group can make a difference because we're here in the name of the Lord. We're the children of the King. This is the gospel of Christ. This is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And we serve in his name, doing his work in his way. Who knows what great good can come from that? We really don't need to know all the particulars about the good that it does, do we? We don't need to get that information in order to have confidence that it does good, to sow the seed of the kingdom. You know, in my work as a writer, especially in these days of digital communications where you write words and send them out there into cyberspace, you don't very often know where they go, and sometimes you do wonder whether that's doing any good or not. You have no idea who's reading those words, if anybody, and occasionally you get a little bit of input, but not very much. And so, quite frankly, there are days when I sit down to write and wonder if there's any point in trying to continue to do that. What difference would it make if I quit today and didn't write any more pages? What difference would it make? Well, shame on me for thinking that. If that's what I can do in the Lord's work, and I believe it is, you know, there are some preachers that do a little writing. You're listening this week to a writer who tries to do a little preaching. I believe that's what I can do. And I better keep doing it. In the confidence that it does good to do good. It does good to sow seed. I write and we preach and we work and we serve. We sow seed in the confidence that it will make a difference for good. Whether that information ever comes to us or not, it's encouraging to us when we get positive input. And all of us do once in a while. We get little measures of encouragement from those who will tell us that something we've done has been helpful to them. That's enough to keep us going. You know, a little bit of that goes a long way. But we need to keep in mind that he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. And maintain hope. I'm afraid many of us develop kind of a fortress mentality. You know, we just are so used to being a minority that nobody is listening to that we kind of withdraw into the walls of our little fortress, and most we can do is throw a tract out there once in a while and say, "World, take that!" See if that's really going to overcome the world. We can do better than that. The Lord is on his throne. His word is mighty to accomplish his purposes. If we are truly his people, then we need to be imbued with a sense of hope and confidence that his work will accomplish exactly what he wants it to accomplish. Finally, I want to suggest that we need to maintain gratitude for our blessings. I'm talking now about us as congregations. All of us individually have a lot of things to be thankful for. And I don't know you very well here at Gettysburg, but I've been tickled to death to learn what I have learned about you this week. You're a tremendously encouraging, refreshing group of people. And I'm quite sure that it's not hard at all for you to be thankful for one another. But I have been places where when you recommend that people ought to be grateful for one another, brethren kind of come out afterwards and say, "Well, I'll work on that. That's not going to be easy, but I'll work on that." But I'll tell you, you never were a member of any congregation that didn't have things about it that you could rightfully be thankful for. If Paul can begin his first letter to the Corinthians on a note of gratitude, knowing what we know about the sorry shape of what was going on in Corinth, if Paul could find things even at Corinth to be grateful for, I'm quite sure we can find things to be thankful for where we worship. I say that's true individually as well as congregationally. Sometimes our individual lives get to where they're looking kind of dark, don't they? And it looks, you know, if we don't look with very much of a wide angle lens, it may sometimes look like the bad outnumbers the good, but that's never really true. You never had a day individually, and you have never had a day congregationally, here or anywhere else, where there was not more to be thankful for than there was to be worried about. The good always outnumbers the bad if we'll discipline ourselves to see it and to be thankful for it and to reinforce those good things. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 17, a very familiar verse where Paul says that whatever we do, we're to do in the name of the Lord. And what the last part of that verse says, which we don't pay much attention to, but giving thanks to Him. We preach a lot about the first part of the verse, that it's important for us to do everything we do by the Lord's authority, and that's certainly a fact. But I believe it's no less important for us to be thankful. Don't think the Lord would be any more pleased with a church that would bring a piano in here and begin to worship with it than He would be pleased with a congregation that had quit being thankful to Him for His blessings. One would be about as sinful as the other and as destructive as the other to the Lord's work. We all are thankful, I think, for one another in our more serious moments. We just don't verbalize that as often as we ought to. We don't express how grateful we are. Several years ago, a very dear husband and wife couple who live in another state sent me a rather sizable check to help me in my financial work, the financial support of my work. And I was very, very busy at the time and didn't get a thank you note written very quickly and soon forgot about it. Just didn't get them thanked until a couple of years later when I returned to the congregation where they are for a meeting and stood up to preach on Sunday morning, looked out and saw them in the audience, and just killed me to think the great sacrifice that they had made. I had not even said thank you for it. Well, that was several years ago, and I've been embarrassed about it ever since, though I made profuse apologies to them and did what I could to thank them on that occasion. They were very, very gracious about it. Well, That was several years ago, just last week. Another check in the same amount arrived from them. I thought, well, they're going to give Gary a second chance. Let's see how he does this time. I'll tell you, I'm going to get that thank you note written. How many times have you intended to thank somebody? I'm not now just talking about things that somebody would do for you, but just some contribution they make to the Lord's work. How many times have you appreciated that but never communicated that to them? It's hard to keep working, isn't it, when you don't see any evidence that anybody appreciates what you do? We don't work just so that others will praise us. It certainly shouldn't be our motive, but it's hard to keep going long term if it seems like nobody cares and nobody appreciates it. The other side of that is there is nothing any more powerful that you can do to help somebody keep going than to say thank you. And it be genuine, not just be blowing smoke on them, but I mean genuinely let them know that you appreciate what they do. I said a minute ago, a little bit of that goes a long way. That'll keep somebody going for quite some time if they hear those wonderful words, thank you. And that's something that we can do. We need to be thankful for one another, express gratitude for one another, and express gratitude to God for one another. And be specific about it. I'm sure you from time to time thank God for your brothers and sisters here at at Gettysburg. Do you ever name names to the Lord? That would be a good thing to do, to be more specific than just a generic, Lord, I appreciate my brethren at Gettysburg. But to go down the list and name some names and tell the Lord exactly how and why you are thankful for them. Does all kinds of good things for our work when we are thankful to the Lord for his blessings, thankful to one another for things that we do, and thankful to the Lord for our brethren. And the only other remaining piece of that is that it's good to occasionally to verbalize to others how thankful we are to the Lord for his blessings. It just builds strength in every direction when we maintain gratitude for our blessings. When other problems come up, if you will bathe those problems in gratitude, they'll be much more easily resolved. If you will handle problems that come up within an atmosphere of gratitude for one another, you'll find that they'll have a very different resolution than when you pursue those things with personal enmity and animosity. So remember what our work is. Live above little petty concerns. Really believe that we can make a difference in the communities where we are, in the Lord's strength. And in all of that, remember to be thankful to the Lord and to our brethren. Challenges that we meet in life can be met successfully. There's always a right approach. There's always some right thing that we can do to meet any challenge. I don't care whether it's individual or congregational. When Paul says about temptation in general in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, that the Lord will always provide a way of escape. There's a broad principle there that has to do with more than just temptations. If it's a problem, you can assume that the Lord is always going, there's always going to be some right thing that can be done about that problem. There will always be some right approach that can be taken to handling that. And we need to choose that way of escape, whether it's temptation or difficulties or whatever it may be, and strap on the Lord's armor and do his work with his strength. Who knows how long we will have to continue to do the Lord's work until he returns. Sometimes I would like to know whether that's going to be sooner or later, but we don't know, do we? It might be a long time from now. It might be many, many more generations have to come and go before the Lord returns, and then again, it may be before this night is over. We don't have time this week for me to do my reaching forward lessons, but I spend a lot of my time in my life right now delivering those lessons on Philippians 3 about reaching forward to the things that are ahead. And if you know anything about things that I've written in the past, you know that I have the view that we ought to be eager to go to heaven, that to depart and be with Christ would be far better than anything you ever enjoyed on your best day in this world. And I hope the Lord will return sooner rather than later. If he doesn't, then we've got work to do in the meantime. We don't just sit down and bemoan the fact that the Lord hadn't come back already and we wish he would. No, we stay busy. We work. As long as this is the work time. But I'm glad for what Paul said about it in Romans chapter 13, verse 11, when he said, our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. With every day that passes, we are one day closer to the goal, to home, to seeing our Father's face. Meanwhile, the Lord said to his people in Philadelphia, don't you let anybody take your crown. Fight, work, serve. Love one another. Love your fellow man. But be aware of the fact you've got an adversary who's trying to destroy you. Make up your mind that whatever problem he presents for you is not going to be successful. In the strength of the Lord, you are not going to be robbed of your salvation. It takes a certain amount of just holy stubbornness to go to heaven. And I recommend that to you. Don't let anybody take your crown. Let's meet our challenges in the strength of a Lord who is perfectly capable of doing whatever has to be done. Well, I forgot all about the song that I was going to make mention of. Number 250. You remember what the third verse of that song began by saying? It talks about a time when free from envy, scorn, and pride, our wishes all above, each can his brother's failings hide and show a brother's love. Be a great time, wouldn't it, if a time arrived when we were free from envy, scorn, and pride, and all of those little things. Well, there come a time when all of that little thinking will have been left behind. We'll be in heaven. Everything will be as it should be. Right now, there's work to be done, and we struggle to meet these challenges. And I want you to know how much I appreciate what I see of the work you're doing here at Gettysburg and the way in which you're doing it. I've known of you for so long, known so many of you, some of you from quite a distance, some of you I've known in other places. I've known of the Lord's work in this place for many, many years. And I must tell you that I came here with great reluctance, with fear and trepidation, wondering what in the world somebody like me could possibly have to say that would help people who are so strong in the Lord already. I certainly don't have anything new to teach you that you don't already know. And you could much more easily encourage me in the Lord's work than I can you. You've got it much more nearly right than I do. But it's about trying to share what we have and help one another. And so let's do that. You have encouraged me this week. If you've gotten anything out of these lessons, we'll just consider that extra. But I've been refreshed and encouraged. And I want to thank you on this Wednesday night, when usually it's just the home folks and it's just us, for who you are as a congregation. Thanks for being who you are. You are a beacon of light that extends far beyond the borders of Pennsylvania. Thank you for that. Well, we'll sing an invitation song that Stephen has announced. What is it, 255? And we'll let this be an opportunity for anybody who needs to come forward and let us know how we can render assistance in the Lord. If you would avail yourself of our help, we'd be honored to extend that help to you. Won't you come as we stand and sing?